My name is Katie Stewart, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Writing on the Wall, From Disaster to Doing Something. On August 29, 2005, millions of lives were turned upside down as Hurricane Katrina, the greatest natural disaster in U.S. history, struck Louisiana and Mississippi. In Louisiana alone, over 1,500 residents perished, while approximately 200,000 were left homeless. Katrina severely debilitated the New Orleans infrastructure, which remains in a weakened state today, as many hospitals, schools, and routes of public transportation still operate below capacity or not at all. Thousands continue to live as refugees, while recovery and reconstruction within the city progress at a lethargic pace. Katrina's impact was disproportionately felt by African Americans, the poor, and the unemployed of New Orleans, as they comprised a majority of the residents in the damaged areas. Although these communities suffered the most damage, they have received the least assistance and are experiencing the slowest recovery. The persistence of inequalities of race, gender, and class are evident, and as both the local and national governments, as well as local business, have failed to provide for the rebuilding of communities and the infrastructure necessary for people to return to the city. Steady employment with a living wage is still widely unavailable to those wishing to return to their home due to privatization and lack of government assistance. Activism among community-based political groups has arisen in response to the corruption and neglect by the local and national governments and local business. These groups call upon the city to address the inequalities in the recovery process so that people may return to their homes with a solid infrastructure and job market to protect and serve them. Community-based political groups are not only present in New Orleans, but throughout the United States. A growing integrated network of political action groups, or a counter-topography of activisms, calls for review of and changes in politics and policies that undermine the social wage. Professor Cindy Katz is here today to discuss how the government and business fail to provide for the recovery of the poor in New Orleans, and how the community-based political groups that rose in response connect to other such groups across the U.S. forming a larger social movement. Professor Katz is a renowned urban geographer and professor of geography and environmental psychology and women's studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She specializes in the areas of social reproduction and production of space, place, and nature, gender, children and the environment, and the consequences of global economic restructuring for everyday life. Along with researching activism, social reproduction, and the enduring effects of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Dr. Katz is currently investigating the intertwined spaces of homeland and home-based security. Professor Katz has written extensively on these subjects, and she's been published in many prominent journals. She also published a book, Growing Up Global, Economic Restructuring and Children's Everyday Lives, which won the Association of American Geographers Meridian Award in 2004. She has received numerous other honors, including a fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University and a Women's Studies Scholarship in Residence at West Virginia University. Dr. Katz graduated from Clark University with an AB, MA, and PhD in geography. At this time, I'd like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming Dr. Cindy Katz.
Thank you, Katie, and I want to thank all of you for coming. I'm sorry, I have a cold, so bear with me. I want to thank Heather Merrill for inviting me and Karen Fries and Jolie Rankin for bearing with me before this, arranging everything so fabulously. So it's great to be here, and I now feel that the subtitle of the talk is From Disaster to Doing Something, and I think the doing something is something that many of you have been doing, so I hope in the question and answer I can hear some of what you've been doing, because at dinner I heard a lot of interesting things. So I'm not expecting a call. I don't have a watch. It's the new clock of life. Okay, I want to start by acknowledging Helen Hill, who some of you may have heard of. She was a filmmaker, a beautiful and talented filmmaker, and an activist in New Orleans. She was a dedicated member of her community. She was kind of quirky. She was a vegan with a pot-bellied pig. And by all accounts, a loving and spirited neighbor and family member and activist. Last year, on January 4th, she was murdered in her home in New Orleans before her husband and toddler's eyes. It was only January 4th, so hers was the sixth murder in New Orleans at that point. Sixth murder in 24 hours, part of a week in which there were 12 murders, and the start of a year that saw 99 murders by July 1st. The day that Helen Hill was killed, I was supposed to give a talk. I was in New Orleans to do some research, and I was supposed to give a talk at a storefront art center called Zeitgeist. And I got there, and the manager and founder of Zeitgeist was utterly distraught and beside himself, and learned of the murder. And, you know, I said, forget the talk. Go. You need to be with your friends. And so it was, you know, within a few days of my being in New Orleans, my life intersected with one of many, many, many tragic deaths in the city. But because that happened, I felt spurred to find out about her life, you know, that just that making of this statistic an intimate part of my life. I found out some of what she had been working on and found out some of the things I said. And she was a filmmaker and making an animated film called The Florestein Collection. And that film was about a dressmaker who had made dresses out of little scraps of material that she'd found in just in thrift stores and her own and her family's worn out clothes. And Florestein was a 90-year-old blind woman, and she had patched together these dresses of all these colors and textures and design. And when Florestein died, someone disposed of the dresses, and Helen Hill found them in a thrift shop. And so she got inspired to make this animated film about her. And that's a kind of bricolage. What Florestein felt was that all that patchwork made into all these beautiful dresses was a metaphor for New Orleans. And Helen thought that Florestein's metaphor was another metaphor for New Orleans. So I'm trying, this is not as much of a patchwork, and it's certainly far less creative and beautiful, but I've tried to kind of honor that project with my own work. Because New Orleans and the tragedy of Katrina really kind of calls forth that sort of response. As most of you know, and is often said about New Orleans, it's the southernmost port of the United States and the northernmost port of the Caribbean. And it is a city whose strange wonderfulness, and it really is a strange wonderfulness, is a vibrant patchwork of messy, colorful difference. And that colorful, messy difference is usually celebrated more than its hideous horribleness, but those two are usually connected. The hideous horribleness is kind of legacies of venal corruption shot through with racism, deep, even if quirky, racism. And I don't want to get into that kind of hyperbole of cliche that New Orleans produces in us, Northerners, I suppose. But I want to draw that line from Helen Hill's bricolage of Florestein's bricolage to the increasingly apparent fact that New Orleans is not as much that sort of vibrant bricolage anymore, but is in a state of reductive collapse, that all of that vibrancy is being crushed by the events before and after Katrina. I'm not blaming these problems on Katrina. Katrina just scoured the surface so that we could see those things. But it's a different kind of bricolage, perhaps, but it's a form of seeing neoliberal capitalism and what George Lipsitz, cultural theorist, called the social warrant of hostile privatism, that we have in the United States at this point a social warrant to privatize in an aggressive and hostile manner. And that social warrant of hostile privatism really lubricates and naturalizes and sustains the discourse that's become commonplace now. No new taxes. Let people fend for themselves. Let's have charter schools instead of good public schools. All of the ways that privatization has become part of our everyday lives and sometimes feels like the only alternative is something that has been made into a discourse and made into a kind of convincing tale for many people. But yet it produces a situation that's in every way reductive. It closes off every possibility for in the spaces of everyday life of all the sorts of vibrant intersections that are often imagined and talked about. So we at universities talk about how lively difference is and how we have identity politics is all about difference and shared common grounds and differences and celebrated. But in other ways, that gets crushed into a narrowed sphere by this sort of talk of privatism. And it's that vortex and the collapse it suggests that I want to talk about here. Underneath all of that physical wreckage that many of you, I understand, have seen, certainly anyone who's looked at a newspaper once, or a television, I just remembered, has seen it, but many of you I know have been there. But underneath all of that wreckage and debris, what Katrina and the flood in its wake cleared and scoured was an uneven landscape of social reproduction. And it revealed the costs of these long-term disinvestments in the social wage, the toll of that hostile privatism, the patterns of enduring racism, racial segregation, and the peculiar geographies, and in this, New Orleans is more peculiar than many places, of states' rights and cronyism and militarized security all smushed together. It was my long-term interest in social reproduction rather than the events of Katrina that brought me to focus on it. But it seemed impossible to ignore what happened in the wake of the storm, given those interests, given a long-term interest in, and I'll talk about what I mean by social reproduction in a second. But it's illuminating and a little bit horrifying to compare it to the other big disaster of our recent times, September 11th, 2001, regarding the nature of governmental and individual responses. And given the interest of time, I can't really talk about that, but I want to put it in your heads to think about what was the response to September 11th and what was the response to Hurricane Katrina. They're very different, and then in certain ways not so different. In terms of security and military responses. Landfall, let me provide some illustrations. Landfall is not just a physical question. Geography is always socially produced, and every landscape can reveal sedimented and contentious histories of occupancy. Struggles over land use, clashes over meaning, rights to resources, rights to dwelling places, rights to the city. Katrina churned through those historical geographies. And they are historical geographies of amazing environmental wealth. It's the biggest oil-producing state in the country, even bigger than Texas. And that environmental wealth has been exploited in a hideous and sort of aggressively rapacious way over centuries at this point. It's a city of mythic significance in the United States and even in the global imaginary, whose celebrations mask those enduring legacies of poverty and discrimination. The geographer Pierce Lewis characterized New Orleans as impossible but inevitable. And its geography is in many ways impossible, but it's made by people and industry and technologies that have made and remade and unmade and environmental events undo, and then they're redone over the course of many centuries of management, mismanagement, dreamy, ambitious, under and over management. But there's a kind of, and this is a part of environmental exploitation in all kinds of places, a kind of indomitable inventiveness about it, but an extraordinary hubris. You know, you're going to control the Mississippi River. That's pretty ambitious. And yet, it's in many ways done for many years until it fails. Those sedimentations are not just the effects of environmental engagement, but they're the outcomes of all kinds of material practices, not just environmental, not just engineering, not just the events of nature and meeting culture, but all kinds of practices of work and modification. Katrina's landscape, New Orleans, and I focus only on New Orleans, as you probably have already been able to tell. That landscape was also the effect of policy decisions of all kinds, policy decisions made locally, nationally, at the state level. But the hurricane hit at what was then the bottom of three decades-long deterioration of the social wage. A combination of policies, again, associated with what I was referring to as hostile privatism, of policies at all scales of government that really reduced every aspect of social reproduction, education, healthcare, the judicial system, housing, every aspect except those associated with militarism and policing. Louisiana is, it depends how you count, but one of the places considered the prison capital of the country. It has per capita more prisoners than any other state in the nation. So when the hurricane happened, it was easy to see the costs of those disinvestments, the costs of neglect of crucial infrastructure. And even New Orleans's intricate levee system was eroded and in poor repair. And the population just prior to the storm was about 484,000 people, and it's less than half of that now. But in 1960, the population was 600,000 people, and the loss of over 100,000 people since 1960 was the effect of white flight and suburbanization, something that happened in many large cities across the United States, and that this loss, which has yet to be returned, these people, the diaspora of New Orleanians, is not necessarily going to be reversed. So it's a huge change in the nature of the city. Within this landscape of depletion, New Orleans was worse off than many U.S. cities. As I said, its prison population was large. Its schools were failing. It has a perfunctory public defender apparatus. I can never not say this. It was funded by parking tickets. So that's the only source of funds for the public defenders. There's a city of extraordinary poverty. And so if indigent people are defended by free public defenders who are paid by parking tickets. It's not a very fair, equitable justice system, and your chances of having legal representation that's adequate is fairly low. In August 2005, right before the storm, 27% of the population lived below the federal poverty line. The unemployment rate was over 10% citywide, but over 40% in certain neighborhoods, such as the Lower Ninth Ward. Two-thirds of the city's public schools were labeled failing, and there was a single public hospital required to treat poor people. In the geographer Clyde Wood's terms, the city was or its neighborhoods were in demographic collapse, that there was just this kind of pressure that's reducing the survivability of many of the parts of the city. And the hurricane revealed this demographic collapse and the conditions that produced it in a way that was shocking on a national and world scale, but even shocking within the city itself in many ways. There was a wholesale abandonment of the poor on the part of the state and capital, and that is not just a turn of phrase there. It was really a social fact, which we all saw if you turned on the television during that time and saw what was happening in the Superdome, saw people lying on luggage, whatever those belts, sleeping in the airport. And it's truly was astonishing to see this, but perhaps even more astonishing is that now, more than almost 2.5 years later, not as much has been changed or rectified in its wake as might be expected, or as would be expected in any other place, I think. To look at the response to Katrina within the framework of social reproduction reveals the extent and gravity of pressing issues on the ground. And I want to talk about five different aspects of social reproduction that were crucial to making this dinner we talked about. There's no such thing as a natural hazard, but that made this natural event, a big hurricane, into a disaster. And these aspects of social reproduction are part of what produced a disaster out of a natural event. In this context, I also want to ask, where do the means of social reproduction come from and with what consequences? So who's responsible for restoring everyday life, for reclaiming and reconstructing the infrastructure of the city, for returning the provisions associated with the social wage, again, housing, healthcare, education, legal system, things like that. This work of the social wage and of social reproduction is infrastructural, it's structural, it's social, it's political, economic, and it's cultural. And it's accomplished by a fluid combination of households and individuals, the business, whether through the workplace or through commercial enterprise, the state, does the government provide these things, and through the civil society or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, various institutions like religious groups and community organizations. And social reproduction almost by definition always happens. If it doesn't, then there really is complete collapse. So it's got to somehow happen. But when the state abandons its responsibility and business abandons its responsibility, it's left to individuals and households and community groups to secure those means of existence to ensure that people can survive from day to day, year to year, generation to generation. And so that's what was at stake and what got thrown off in particular ways as a result of Katrina. So on the one hand, my point is that the nature of the response to the storm, or the lack thereof, is indicative of the effects of long-term disinvestment in these parts of everyday life, and the commitment of business and government to privatization, which is part of a much larger political context in the U.S. The fact is, it produced a crisis, and the crisis, it, as many people like to point out, it also provides an opportunity to do something, and all kinds of somethings happened. So although the first, probably two-thirds of my talk gets grimmer and grimmer, there's a lot of things to feel encouraged about in terms of the sorts of activist responses that were seen in the failures of a lot of the institutional and governmental and business arenas. So I will cheer up at the end. My voice won't be any better, but I will smile maybe. So what are those elements of social reproduction? As I said, it encompasses all of these social practices of everyday life. Katie was interviewed me before, and I feel like I gave my whole talk in the interview, but didn't I? See, I have nothing else to say. But I said at that, she said, what's social reproduction? And I said, I kind of think it's everything. Since I've studied it for like 900 years, I actually do think it's everything. But it's everything that's not production. But it's the stuff of everyday life that allows everyday life to continue. So it allows production to continue. It's how we make the means of production and the people to make it work. So it includes making machinery and factories and all of those things, but also securing a sustainable environment and resources that can be used in production. It's producing a differentiated and differently skilled labor force. It's providing for all of the social learning, knowledge, cultural aspects of by which we live our lives as social beings. And so it's, as I said, it takes place in all these different settings, but it includes both the kind of physical aspects of generational and daily reproduction, but also the cultural, social, and environmental aspects of it. And I won't go any more into that. So I want to talk very briefly about five aspects of this in New Orleans. The first is the environmental and infrastructural aspect, where New Orleans has a fairly unique requirement of extensive water management, which has been taken care of in recent decades by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And it's interesting to note, as I mentioned earlier, with neoliberalism and in the last 30 years, there's been a downloading of responsibility for social reproduction. So the state doesn't take care of very much anymore. It puts it off on households and civil society much more than was in the past. But with the levee system, that's the one area there the control has gone upscale. So it used to be the responsibility when New Orleans was settled of private property owners. Then it was taken care of by the municipality and the state government, and now it's federal responsibility. So in the management of water is the one area where the federal government has taken the response, for better or worse, perhaps worse, has responsibility for this. Now, as we all know, this levee system was built to withstand a Category 3 storm. Katrina was larger than that. But it was also in poor repair, so that it was only a matter of time before a large enough storm would hit and the levees would fail, which was precisely what happened. The vulnerability is amplified by the insurance industry's reluctance to underwrite property in this in the area. Let's change the scenery here. The other part of the infrastructural aspect is the federal government's responsibility for emergency relief. So FEMA, this slide is to make the point that we are in a petrochemical state, and part of the water problems are from channeling the Mississippi River for in the interests of the oil and petrochemical industries. This is no longer working in the bayou, but and most of you know images like this, I'm sure. But this was a year and a half after the storm in the lower Ninth Ward. All of these houses, none of them occupied as of that time. And I have learned that FEMA, not only did FEMA make all of the blunders, which we know so well about, but the emergency management of New Orleans was in the hands of privatized in the hands of a group called Innovative Emergency Management. And it appears that the innovation was they had no plan. So it was, in fact, quite innovative. They had no expertise. As we know, FEMA had been deprofessionalized under Bush as well. But Innovative Emergency Management had no plan, for example, for the 120,000 people who didn't own private cars. So these are people who can't just kind of get out of town if they had had adequate warning. They need assistance. And none of this was taken care of. Part of what FEMA had been preoccupied with prior to the storm was questions of security in the wake of September 11th. And this is directly related to social reproduction. The security has been obsessively focused on terrorism, not at environmental hazards, not at other dangers to social life and environment. And the concern with having security, too, trumps the sort of security of. And so the military expenditures and policing take the form of investments that take money away from securing the mundane parts of everyday life. So there's not no money. There's money. I know that's a bad sentence, but that makes it memorable. And the money goes to the other Gulf, not this Gulf. And some of the same characters are operating in both Gulfs. So Blackwater Security and Halliburton, to name two of the most notorious, have major contracts in both places to provide security. So that's where a lot of the emphasis has been in the restoration. And there's a FEMA trailer. This one at least is outside of the people's house rather than in a big FEMA trailer park where thousands of trailers are just put behind a cyclone fence. But can you imagine living in that for a year and a half or even a day and a half? Okay, I want to quickly go through, because I know time is racing and I'm not. So I want to quickly go through the other aspects of social reproduction because they all sort of blend together. Healthcare. Healthcare is crucial to any form of social reproduction. This is Charity Hospital, which was completed in 1939 and suggests a commitment to people's health. You know, a big, solid commitment, you know, partly because Huey Long's populism, which used petrodollars, was put into providing for poor people at some level. So this hospital, beautiful doors, decoration, closed, and not to reopen. And all of the emergency generators were on the first and second floors. This is not a place to put the emergency stuff. I mean, I'm not part of innovative management, but I know that. So it's padlocked, boarded, not, and I predict condos. This is public housing, and as I want to quickly move through these parts of social reproduction. Housing has been mentioned by every activist I talk to as the linchpin of the return to a decent social and differentiated social life in New Orleans. This, you see no mud, no flood water marks, no damage, but you see these things are closed and sealed and bolted tight. There are every public housing project in New Orleans, all but two, were closed after the storm and not reopened. Most of them have yet to be reopened. And one of the projects, for example, Lafitte, is between the French Quarter and the Central Business District. So it's nice prime real estate. And I know I sound cynical, and I know I sound angry, and I am both at this point, because it's quite clear that there's an intention to close public housing and privatize it. The federal government's head of housing and urban development is on record as against public housing. They are in favor of mixed income housing, but the mixed income housing mixes at a much higher level than people who live in public housing. So the housing of New Orleans has been closed, as you probably remember, the notorious statement by Richard Baker, a Republican congressman from Baton Rouge, who said, and I quote, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did." So this is no way to find out there's a God, but that sentiment speaks volumes about what's going on, because when I have toured the city and seen the different public housing developments and seen that to date people have not been allowed to move back in. Masonry building, decent in many ways. You see that it's an intentional policy. And if that's not changed, it will be very hard to get people to move back to be nurses, to be teachers, to be service workers, to be home health care workers, to be auxiliary medical workers. And that was the problem when I only glossed over this in health care, but there's tremendous shortages of staff, nurses more than doctors, health care workers more than both, because they can't afford to live in the city without adequate, affordable housing, always an interesting term. But without public housing, and in the time since, the this is another picture of it. This because it says for rent. I've kept this the leftover. Everything just stopped. But private market housing, the rents have gone up by nearly 100%. So there's rent, there's unaffordable rents, and there's no public housing. This is another public housing, and this is a prison. Can I? It's a little connection to be drawn about that form of public housing. So one of the things I just want to talk briefly about education in connection with housing is that one of the things I really noticed being there is how much, it's of course obvious, but it was made palpable being there, how much schools anchor neighborhoods. So elementary schools are almost definitionally the heart of a neighborhood. In the worst hit areas, the schools were flooded and are closed and are still not open again. With a teacher shortage and not enough money for reconstruction, schools have not reopened. So children have to be bused all around the city to go to schools with unfamiliar children on familiar teachers and far distant from their houses. This is not a good setting, and it discourages families from returning to the city. So this whole interlocking system, which is all about social reproduction and the social wage, really shows this kind of gridlock in return. You can't get teachers and nurses and housing. You have to get them all sort of at once. And there's been very little attention to doing any of that. I won't spend more time. I wanted to talk about what we could, if anybody cares, but what the kind of federal government has, this road home program, which is only for homeowners, not for renters. 55% of the city were renters. So there's no aid to reconstruct your house. And even at that, less than a third of the applicants have received their money 2.5 years later. So it's very slow, very bureaucratic, very much about delaying. The social justice system is the fifth part of social reproduction I wanted to mention. And as I said, the public defender system's funded by parking tickets. Since the storm, there really is no parking. So there's no parking tickets. So there's no money for this. And the other side of the aisle, the district attorney's office, are the most poorly paid district attorneys, assistant district attorneys in the nation. So there's very problematic social justice. There's a very high prison population. This is the city jail. People stay in apparently dreadful, dreadful, dreadful conditions for sometimes 2 months. There's a new kind of crime called a misdemeanor murder because people don't get tried, don't get indicted in the proper amount of time and have to be released. So people spend 60 days in this jail and they're out because nothing's happened. So there's a kind of a complete breakdown of the legal system, which is provoking what many legal scholars and lawyers are considering a constitutional crisis. And that doesn't get talked about as much. Okay. Enough of the grim talk. Okay. In the wake, I find this to be a very poignant slide because it's a hand-painted street sign. So this is a street in the lower Ninth Ward, done by Common Ground. There had been no even rudimentary reconstruction in the city. Street signs, perhaps to help volunteers find places that they were supposed to go to do some work, so that even the most basic things have been handled by volunteers and activists. So these failures of business and the state, which are intentional, some are accidental, some are long-standing, some were quite sudden, but they've left a gaping wound ripe for activism and action. And the responses of grassroots and community groups and national volunteers and religious groups and all kinds of organizations and agencies and philanthropies worldwide have been extraordinary. And many of these activities are ongoing, and they're key to bringing New Orleans back in any way. And some of you may have volunteered for Common Ground. There's an enormous number of students who go during semester break and over the summer and do cleanup work. There is among the organizations, ACORN, the Common Ground Collective, the Common Ground Free Clinic. So filling in for the absence of Charity Hospital, which this little clinic can't do all the work of that big giant hospital. A group called Critical Resistance Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, and Safe Streets, Strong Communities. And each of those are sort of pegged to the different aspects of social reproduction I've named. These groups and their allies have, across the board, filled in for the missing state, made street signs, done cleanup, done decontamination and renovation work in houses, lent tools, provided immunizations and emergency health care, and pro bono lawyer work, done advocacy for survivors and people scattered all over the place about their rights of return, their rights to vote. They have done this largely with volunteer labor. And the efforts have been extraordinary. So each of these houses in the Lower Ninth Ward was being completely gutted by volunteers working with the owner. Here's some volunteers. Each house on this block, this one was, the work was underway. This is People's Hurricane Relief Fund, which takes a more oppositional stance in response to the storm, in which they were rallying to get the rights of renters to get money from the federal government to be return to their housing, to fix their houses, to undo the locking out in public housing, to agitate against the government did not to provide for services and housing and rent relief. The Common Ground squatted this building, which had been privatized, and as soon as they successfully established their squatter settlement, they were evicted by the landlord. People have come from all over the country to volunteer, and it has brought out the best and the worst of what we know of the United States and of ourselves. And it's contradictory to think about the role played by activists and volunteers and philanthropies, because in one way it's fabulous and we want ways that we can all be effective, politically engaged, and contribute to remaking New Orleans, but also to being activists against these problems in our own communities. But in another way, it confirms the disinvestment by the state and by business, because the gap has been filled in. I mean, not to the extent that it needs to be, but you look at volunteers, you look at religious organizations, you look at philanthropic donations, and it's just confirmed in certain ways the neoliberal rhetoric of, if we don't give them handouts, they'll do it themselves. And so there has to be at least a recognition of the contradictory nexus between those places. So I just want to wrap up now by talking about some of the issues of pressing concern for the activists with whom I've interviewed. Because what can be done under these dire circumstances, which more than 2 years later remain dire? Part of what the complaint has been is that there's a kind of return of it may have never left, a kind of paternalism and neocolonialism to the way these philanthropic organizations have worked, a kind of, these people cannot govern themselves. We have to come tell them what to do. So the activists complained about the fact that they were being forced to be professional, to fill in grant applications make a dozen copies of the applications, prove that they're using the money effectively, demonstrate efficiency, and yet, from the Northeast and from the Beltway, 13 different big philanthropies would come down. You know, let me check, let me go on my junket, let me go on mine, let me, you know. And so they said, they want us to be efficient. Why aren't they efficient? Why can't one person from the Ford Foundation come here and say to Rockefeller, Carnegie, whomever, they, you know, this is what they need, this is what they're doing. Why do they all have to come tripping over themselves and yet discipline us about how to ask for money? And it's a really important point. The other thing is that as wonderful and important as volunteering is, and all of us who have done things like that, this is not to diminish that, very often it's like 2 weeks in, 2 weeks out. If you go for 2 weeks, you can contribute to cleaning up a house or doing some demo work or painting some street signs, and all of that is great. But they need long-term change. And when I asked several of them, what could I do in New York? I don't want to be, it's also sensitive, the North, South, the carpetbagger, the everything else kind of, there's lots of histories, lots of twisted histories in this. And one of the things several people said is, you could organize about these things in New York. You have privatization of public housing. You have poor public schools. You have no money for health care. All of the things that we see more clearly, perhaps, in New Orleans, we all have. I'm sure much of this exists in this area, in Carlisle, in Harrisburg. There's similar problems. Why not organize in your own backyard about these things, and at some point, there's common cause. And at some points, we make those connections both literally but also figuratively. And that struck me because, as Katie mentioned, she used the word counter-topography, and this is by way of concluding. In my work, I've talked about counter-topographies, which I understand as kind of a link among different places that are affected by similar problems. So I'm a geographer, but I'm not a good physical geographer, so I think of topographies as having contour lines, and those are places that connect places of similar elevation, but they don't have everything in between. And I want to connect places that have similar problems and say, here's how we're responding, here's how we're responding. And sometimes there's information, people, resources, ideas, activist impulses that travel along those contour lines. And sometimes it's just enough to know that they're happening in multiple locales, and it's a way to confront those problems, which could seem like it's just those people in New Orleans, it's just those people in New York, that's a problem of Bangladesh. It's not just a problem of Bangladesh, it's a problem of all of ours. So to make these sorts of contour lines seems to me one of the most important things we can do in a way that would sustain the efforts in New Orleans. And just after I had that conversation, those conversations, it turned out that there was a demonstration at the Housing Authority of New Orleans that brought housing activists from 7 different places in the United States to New Orleans around those issues, but they were all housing activists in their own cities. And for me, it was particularly bizarrely gratifying. This is narcissistic, perhaps, but it's an organization in New York that I work with and the organization in New Orleans. So I thought, wow. So these things do happen, and the important thing is for there to be solidarity, not charity. This is what Common Ground asks for, and there's all kinds of ways to provide it and all kinds of places to do that. Thanks. The microphone comes to you.
We can start off with us, I guess. As you know, we've been taking students down to Louisiana for the last 3 years, and we had the chance to work in East New Orleans and in Ninth Ward, as well as the Vietnamese community further out. In both cases, there's quite a bit of reconstruction going on, but it's going through the local churches. We know about Common Ground, and Common Ground is considered by many to be an alien outside force. Because it's felt that these are outside volunteers coming in who are not working through, in their minds, existing social structures that first have to be reestablished and then strengthened. And in this case, it is the local churches and the volunteers that they bring in, busloads from the United Methodists and so forth, that we have observed to be doing the most work, not necessarily Common Ground. So I'm wondering why you're focusing on Common Ground and how has that been received by the other, groups of faith down there that come from existing social structures?
I'm not focusing on Common Ground, although that's where my pictures are, because that was where the people who took us around took us. But I'll answer the question about the churches in one second because it's perfect the way I avoid this. But the organization that I really think is the local housing organization is People's Hurricane Relief Fund, of a secular variety, and they are quite critical of Common Ground as being outsiders and people from the Louisiana Environmental Action Network were also quite critical of Common Ground. And then Common Ground has split between the Common Ground Clinic and Common Ground. But then they also do get a lot done and importantly galvanize outsiders to find a way to come in there who are not religiously based. The reason I said it's perfect is that I know I have to really deal with the religious groups, but I have not done this yet, and I am also the person who spent many, like 20 years working in Sudan about resistance, and really the resistance was in a religious vein, and I just wouldn't go there. So it's my own fundamentalist secularism that prevents me from seeing, refuses to see something that I have to see. So I appreciate the question. I'd like to hear more about what they oppose, but the, what? Get connected to the religious groups? Okay, that's good. But did you meet the People's Hurricane Relief people? Yeah, because they are critical of Common Ground as outsiders. Although
concern also is Common Ground comes in for 2 weeks, becomes volunteers, just like Greenpeace very often.
Yeah.
Has an event, and then they split, and Common Ground has its block down there in the lower Ninth Ward, but they really haven't expanded much beyond that one block which they've reclaimed.
But in Algiers, the stuff with the clinic is very different. And the healthcare things they're doing are, which is different group entirely. But I think that's been more effective. I know it was one of those things, like before I went there, that like everybody else from the outside, I thought they sounded great, and I had donated money, and then I went there, and I was like, ugh. And then I kind of spent a year resisting them, and now I've kind of gone back to at least acknowledging that they do something, and especially with students. And I think it's important to not diminish. It's a way for people to come, you know, who don't have another way. Anyway, I appreciate your comment. I'll get to a church one day. I'm sorry.
Cindy, I was trying to think about if it makes sense. I'm a geologist, so I have a slightly different view on this. But as you look at the layers of sediment, there's repeated evidence of hurricanes and storms inundating where New Orleans is. It's an engineered city. Does it make sense to keep tempting fate in rebuilding here? Or was this, as an outsider in a very callous statement, a missed opportunity to relocate an entire city and try and make it less susceptible to future storms? I mean, there's sea level rise, there's coastal erosion, the area is more and more susceptible. Why not move north of Lake Pontchartrain?
Because part of sedimentation is social and cultural and historic, and this is home. I agree from a kind of environmental engineering standpoint, it would be great to not rebuild in these lower areas. When that was proposed immediately after the storm by quite well-intended and informed both geographers, geoscientists, and hazard managers and the like, it was what parts of the city would not be rebuilt are the lowest-lying areas, which is where the poorest people live. So it then says, we're going to rebuild, but without you. I mean, that's already kind of what's going on otherwise, but I think it's really problematic. I also think, and I'm not at all a physical scientist, but that a lot of the problems are, the tempting of fate is the result of all kinds of environmental manipulation of channeling and canals and this, you know, so those things let them force the sediments out to sea and have lowered the sea level and don't allow for the usual kind of ebb and flow of storm surges. So it's already been so engineered. If you want to get rid of the petrochemical industry, you know, that would probably improve New Orleans' chances of survival and everybody else's. I don't think it's viable because it's social history is real.
You mentioned that the level at which mixed income housing starts is higher than that for low income housing. Is that a political policy barrier, or is there a larger social construct behind that?
Well, it's just, no, I'm not sure what you mean, but it's like it's.
Is it a matter of politicians saying, this is the income level at which you could live in this mixed income area, or is there something larger behind the picture which causes them to set it at that level?
Well, the something larger behind the picture is a kind of bourgeoisification of housing. I mean, one of the things I saw in one of the neighborhoods, which was completed before the storm, but this is not unique to New Orleans at all, was this kind of scatter site housing and garden apartment, you know, kind of let's not have housing projects. I'm all for mixed income housing, but there has to be, the policy is not, doesn't enforce that there will be people who live below the poverty line, or it's also social life. Like people say, I can afford not to live near poor people, and I'm going to use that power of my, so in order to make it attractive to middle class people, the balance is shifted far up than, further up the income scale is what I'm trying to say. I don't know technically what the actual policy is, but the houses that they built were wooden, shoddily constructed, but they looked good, you know, so they were all very colorful and had porches and, you know, but I think the construction was the kind of particle board, you know, next storm it'll just fill with water. But people, citywide, every housing activist talked about the fact of this rhetoric of mixed income being the way to smuggle in no affordable housing, a privatization of public housing. I didn't say all the numbers, but there's thousands of people who have been displaced from public housing who have no place to return to. And that's not, like I say, that's not unique to New Orleans. That's happening every place.
I was just wondering, like, how prepared you thought New Orleans was for the next hurricane. Like, you've heard about the levees being rebuilt and new evacuation routes and busing for people who don't have cars. But do you think it'll actually impact if we have another hurricane in Katrina?
Yeah, they've spent $7 billion to get the levees just back to where they were, which is still inadequate. I think in another storm, they will be a little wiser, but not very much more prepared. I don't think that, I mean, it depends partly on the election. I'd like to think that if the federal government changed, there would be at least some serious attention to federal emergency management and that it would be removed from Homeland Security operations, or that the budget for Homeland Security would actually take seriously emergency management, that, you know, there were so many inadequacies the first time around and so many failures. It's hard to imagine that they could repeat all that. Of course, the city's half the size, so there are fewer people to get out and there's fewer poor people to get out, but that's the cynical answer. I don't I don't see a whole lot of change. In fact, I saw this thing where the Innovative Emergency Management Corporation was given a contract to study the failures of the evacuation. So, I mean, sometimes you can't make this stuff up. It's like a farce of history. So that there's this, they're studying who failed. They failed. But they'll tell us what happened. So, yeah, sorry.
I'm here tonight because I heard on NPR about demolition, and they were just going through neighborhoods where houses were being partially repaired and came upon a house in which people were living who had repaired their house. And I just immediately thought, they're demolishing this, they're going to put up developments, it's money, and it sounds like maybe that's what's going on. Guys from here and there and everywhere have come in and seen this as an opportunity for money. And also, who has shut these down, these public housing?
The Housing Authority of New Orleans.
Why do they say?
They say that there are safety concerns. They say that there's infrastructural problems. And then they really are on such thin ice of explanations, because people lived there and weathered the storm quite literally, and to the extent that there was flooding, it was just the ground floor. If you could get into your apartment, you could show that it's not damaged. Now they've left it for 2 years, so it's become more and more derelict. But they're they're just part of it is also the kind of hubris through which these sorts of refusals can take place, that people can just say, it's closed, we're not opening it, or we don't have the funds, or it's not good housing, it was problematic, you need scatter site housing. But the scattering is to Houston, that's a whole new meaning to scatter site housing. And some of that housing's on higher ground, it's in desirable locations, at least some of them. And but there was another. And then the reinvestment and the government assistance for reinvestment has been incredibly lopsided towards private interests. So something like 12 of 18 casinos were reopened within the first year and a half, but only one of seven hospitals. That sort of thing. The Superdome was open by the January afterwards so that the Saints could play. And I'm not saying these things are not important symbolically and even for jobs, but you can go to New Orleans as a tourist now, even a year ago, and not know what's going on within. Just walk two more blocks outside the French Quarter. Just walk three more blocks from the Warehouse or Garden District. And it's devastated in a way that is unimaginable. And I think they create, this little world. I mean, it's always had that effect, like people just go to the French Quarter and they have a good old time. But that has been attended to quite distinctly and nothing else.
New Orleans.
I've only heard of marginal attempts to do this. Do you know any? I'm looking to the activist in chief.
Progressives in New Orleans, the progressive community who support that. It's jobs for people, and we're not going to have people come back and have the people move in unless we have jobs for them. And unfortunately, of course, whatever it is, it's tourism.
I was thinking as you were talking about privatism and the role of that privatism is behind so much of what you're saying, and I was thinking just as a kind of opening comment that maybe we should stop referring it to it as Hurricane Katrina, since that is just a arbitrary name that unfortunately reflects on people who happen to be named Katrina, but maybe we should call it Hurricane Milton in honor of the philosophical parent of privatism, Milton Friedman. Perhaps that would be a little more politically appropriate. But thinking back even further historically, your emphasis really reminded me a lot of the historical work on U.S. welfare policy in the 19th and 20th century by a U.S. social historian who happens to share your last name. I don't know if he's in relation to you. Michael Katz, who's written In the Shadow of the Poorhouse about this tradition in American history of not of trying to rely the strong advocacy for relying on voluntary relief efforts instead of government support and the swinging back and forth. And that all the way back to the poorhouses of the early 19th century. And what that leads me to ask you then is, to what extent do you think this neoliberalism, which you emphasized so much for the last, say, 20 or 30 years, to what extent is that a reflection of long-term currents in American history, or to what extent is it different in the last 20 or 30 years? Do you think there are major differences in the neoliberalism of the last 20 or 30 years, or is this just a reflection of the ebbs and flows of these arguments throughout American history about the relief of the poor?
I think that's a great question. I'm not related to Michael Katz, so I wish. I think a couple of things. I do think there's this kind of tension between the you know, reliance on the state and then the reliance, you know, self-reliance and kind of going towards volunteers and smaller scale. I also feel inner contradiction about being so vocal against, you know, sort of wanting, it sounds like I want the big state, you know, and so sometimes I joke that say, like, come back state so we could smash you. But it's the absence of, and this dates me, and then I see all the people who are my age-ish who at least could chuckle or throw something at me. But so it's not like I want the big state. I like the idea of collective activist engagement in social welfare and in social reproduction of all kinds. But the so that the question about privatization and the responses it's called forth are contradictory at best. You know, that you, so that there's, as I also said, that then whenever when the volunteerism fills in, there's a sense of like, oh, see, we're right. People will take care of themselves. So in U.S. history, there has been that ebb and flow in a contradictory way. If the flood of 1927 called, you know, was sort of a blueprint for the New Deal. You know, with the last time there was a huge flood in the lower Mississippi, right? Lower, not upper. Really, I'm poorly trained. But the response then was a public response, was state response, was just jumping in, and it was by many people, and there's lots written about this, a blueprint for what the New Deal became. But the other thing is I sort of, and many people who talk about neoliberalism harp on 1973 as the year everything changed. And I have this, and I have many reasons, and I won't bore you with them, we can talk about it later, but for why it's 1973, I mean, they're not my, but there's lots of things that happened in the 60s and in the early 70s that made 1973 not just an economic turning point and a point of, you know, changing the currency and devaluation, all of that, there were social, political, economic things that happened. But especially when looking at the Louisiana and southeastern United States issues, to only talk about 1973 is to not look at the long history of hostile privatism there, plantation culture, the kind of whole other way that the South has been treated or denied, you know, been ignored by the state and invested in a kind of privatized, paternalistic, even colonial way, so that that history, especially in the Southeast, is much longer than 1973. But finally, I want to say that I was just at a conference last week with John Clark, who is the person best known as from the Birmingham School Cultural Studies group. And he sent me a paper, but I got it yesterday, so I didn't read it yet. But he said, I want no more talk about neoliberalism, because it's actually made us incapable. It's like made our politics sloppy, so that if we say everything is neoliberalism, that we don't have a way of seeing things in a longer historical perspective. We don't have a way of seeing our own agency in things without feeling somehow it's compromised. So that I was willing to go there, even though I actually thought about it every time I said neoliberalism or privatization tonight. I thought, John, you know, so I'll go read that paper and I'll throw this one out or something. But so anyway, I think it's a good question.
This will be the last question.
The microphone.
Big pressure.
Has
I sort of move it into the global sphere. I don't mean to get off track, but actually, I'm sort of a researcher on Sudan, actually, and I was wondering if you saw some connections between humanitarian response to Katrina and sort of the humanitarian response in Darfur right now. Especially some of the people I've worked with have coined the terms, you know, disaster pornography, or is sort of disaster tourism. Do you sort of see the same sort of trends emerging in the post-Katrina environment as what's happening now in Darfur?
There's definitely disaster tourism in New Orleans, for sure. And I think, I don't know, I mean, people who go to Darfur, I don't know, it's so hard to get there, and it's so kind of impossible once you're
Ethiopia during the famine.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great insight, one that resonates for me in terms of this sort of notions of contra-topography. I think the sense of disaster all over the world and a kind of sense of we know what it is and we'll go there and do something and then we're gone, you know, and then it's the next big bad thing. And I thought about, you know, how you don't hear about, you know, well, there's not much about New Orleans anymore, or about the Katrina stuff, the tsunami, gone. But now with Kenya and Chad, I thought Darfur is about to disappear. And so there's a similar response, both good and bad, or problematic, I shouldn't say good and bad, but problematically invested in the disasters, similar spirit of engagement, but also a similar kind of romantic macho about it, too, that I certainly saw in places in Sudan. I've not been to Darfur in this disaster, but a kind of, I did work for CARE with Eritrean and Ethiopian refugees a very long time ago in eastern Sudan. And many people who were part of the network of refugee resettlement and refugee services were like war heroes, you know, like swapping war stories. Like they'd all been to the same places, they'd all... this is worse than that, and you know. And so there's one way you think it's so great that people will do this work because it needs to be done. There's another way that people get almost addicted to it, and I think some of the impulses are somewhere in between, but I think that's an interesting comparison. I think about that. Thank you. The microphone has spoken. The microphone grip.
On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to present you with this token of our appreciation.
Wow. Thank you.
You are welcome.
That's great. You designed this, right? She designed this. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. This concludes our program. Thank you all for coming. Have a good night.